Okay, so this FAQ session is asking the question, what about the army? Just to introduce this, I'll let you into a confession that it's not much of a confession because I've confessed it before, but in my formative years, I considered myself an anarchist. The reason was that the anarchists I knew were the coolest people around, and they were head and shoulders above everyone else politically and theoretically. Plus, they did a lot of drugs and sex, so, of course, I hung around with them all the time. Then I came across some SPGB members, and not only did their ideas seem more coherent and quite a bit more grown up than the anarchists, they also seemed to do a lot of drugs and sex, so, of course, it was a home from home. I don't half miss the 1980s.
Where was that, Fabian? I missed all that, I'm afraid.
It was all in Lancaster, I'm afraid. Sorry. One anarchist idea that never really gelled with me, though, was this sort of silly notion about taking the state on in the streets, you know, kind of building barricades and chucking Molotov cocktails. It all sounded a bit adolescent to me. And it seemed to me that they hadn't really thought about the army. What were they going to do about the army? The SPGB, on the other hand, seemed to have got it all worked out. No, you can't fight the army in the street, they say, quite right. The army works for the state. What you have to do is take over the state, and then you control the army. Well, that's the argument, as it seemed to me. And as answers went, it seemed better than what the anarchists were saying. But it still seemed to beg a lot of questions. Now, everyone knows that some elected governments have been overthrown in military coups. So it's not entirely true that elected governments always control the army. And so it's not entirely true that taking over the state, by the very fact, neutralizes the army as a force of opposition. Now, it was put to me that there are these things called chains of command, with the top of the chain of command being in Parliament in Whitehall, and this prevents individual army units coordinating horizontally, as it were, without going up the chain, thereby ensuring the complete control of the Defence Ministry and Parliament. Now, my response was that there are also these things called radios, whereby army units can talk directly to each other without anyone in Whitehall necessarily being any the wiser. Now, one thing that members often argue, and quite correctly, is that soldiers are workers too, and that the socialist revolution will rely on the majority of the army to support socialism. The problem is, if you argue that, you're really sidestepping the question I started with. If you can't control the army by taking over the state, and you're just relying on their goodwill, what's the point of taking over the state? So there, that's my question for you this afternoon.
Yeah, Pat, won't these things go hand in hand? While we're being attempted to being voted in and convincing workers, of which the army are workers, obviously it will... They're workers, so they will have to be convinced, just like any other worker, that, and perhaps we will get them leaving the army. I mean, there is already a movement, Veterans for Peace, who have been in the army and have now rejected it all and are speaking out about it. I'm not saying they're obviously not socialists, but they're leaving the army and speaking out. So I think obviously it will all go hand in hand because we can't do anything. I mean, you know, we're not able to do anything until we're the majority. So, you know, and that includes the army. And in fact, I have more sympathy with the army than I ever have with the police force. The police force, you're not really, for instance, in America, young blacks, students are enrolled into the army because the army will pay their university fees and their school fees. So there is an excuse for those poor people because that's the only way they're ever going to get any kind of career. And of course, well, unless they die, of course, But the army will pay for their education. There's no such thing for the police force. They choose to go into the police force. So I think the police are going to be a harder nut to crack than the actual army.
Well, that's interesting. I've never actually heard a member say that before. Well, you might be right, but the thing is about the police, of course, they don't have tanks and fighter planes.
There's the old song. I'll sing you a song and it won't take long, all coppers are bastards. I'll sing you another, it's just like the other, all coppers are bastards. And some of them we are, but they're also workers. The same can be said of soldiers. All soldiers are workers, not doing work that most of us would like to do. They're probably not doing work that most of them very much like to do either. But they're not really in a different position than other workers. And the question arises too that if somehow there was some sort of command structure in the army which was able to deny the will of the people, as it were, via the parliamentary process. The question arises, would those soldiers, as it were, obey them when all around people were doing completely different things? And I think that's something we've got to consider, we've got to bear in mind. And I just think it's highly unlikely.
Yeah, it's a matter of guesswork, though, isn't it? I mean, I do take your point that if there's a majority socialist consciousness around, then soldiers being workers, would they necessarily obey their officers if their officers were ordering them in against workers? It's a good question. We don't know the answer to that. We've seen what soldiers can do. Against workers, for example, at Tiananmen Square. We'll probably see it in Hong Kong, I wouldn't be surprised, as well. So we know they're certainly a tool of the state against workers. I just suppose I was kind of looking for some more concrete argument why the army is not something to be feared in a revolutionary situation, because it does put a lot of people off the idea of revolution because they just assume, oh, well, they'll just call in the army and that'll be that.
Does it put a lot of people off? I mean, I would have thought that was one of the least common arguments against a case that the army won't allow it. All sorts of other arguments, the one we talked about, choose the human nature, all sorts of other arguments, can't have a society without a market, and so on and so forth. But and sometimes people do bring up this thing about, you know, they just crush you if you look dangerous. But I wouldn't say it was one of the most common arguments.
No one got any further thoughts on that? It's going to be a very quick session at this rate.
The army have been known, I can't give examples, but I happen to know, but it's in my memory, that they have refused to shoot into crowds, unless that was the police, because I don't know. But they have refused to shoot their fellow workers in some countries at some points.
There have been police strikes as well in very recent times, but I recall reading an article.
What about the fact that we don't let people in the armed forces into the Socialist Party? If we take the view that they're workers like everybody else, is that not a bit inconsistent?
We not. That's a new one on me.
Well, perhaps we'll perhaps not existing members. And why would they want to join the Socialist Party if they were existing members of the army? I don't suppose they'd ever want to join us. But surely we would be, you know, if it's an ex-army officer or an ex-policeman, it's not a problem, so long as they're a socialist.
Come on, Paddy. Is it true? Is it laid down somewhere that you can't join the party if you're a policeman or a soldier?
I just want to cut in here if I can, because here's an ex-professional soldier who questions a lot of what you've been saying. I think you're really batting around in a blancmange. If you think that soldiers of the British Army would not use their weapons against British civilians or whatever, you're kidding yourselves. I know when I was in, we would have been told to turn on a crowd, we'd have done it. We were paid. We were paid to do a job. We were professionals. And we didn't give a toss about Queen and country. That doesn't enter into it. You've only got to think of Northern Ireland. The British Army used their weapons on British civilians. So, you know, don't kid yourself that... The army would not be prepared to the individual soldiers. You may get the odd few, but the bulk of them will do what they're required to do because they're paid to do it.
That's now, Alan. That's now. It doesn't mean to say that would apply at a time when there was mass socialist consciousness.
I mean, looking at the 1945 Labour government, they put the troops in on workers about 18 times during the course of their government or whatever. You know, it was dockers go slow and things like that. So that they used the troops to ship the goods or whatever, and they did that really. You know, at one point then they got rid of 900 dockers because they'd went go slow and the union was against them, and you know, so I mean, troops have been used to being deployed by Labour governments to actually fight workers. Well, do the workers or whatever who were on strike or on go slow or whatever. So I mean I read a thing in it was International Socialist, they were saying, you know, the 1945 government had a landslide, so the chances that the army would be used against them was slim, so why didn't they do more socialist measures, really, you know? And that's what was said at the time by so-called socialists or whatever.
Well, surely there's a big difference between the army being brought in to clear the bins and break a strike and unload ships than there is with the army being used to come in and shoot people, like we saw in Northern Ireland and, like I say, Tiananmen Square. I don't think the two are really comparable. And sorry also if I interrupted anyone, I accidentally unplugged myself, so I thought no one was talking when you probably were.
Paddy, did you hear me ask the question, where is it laid down the party doesn't allow policemen and soldiers in?
No, I didn't hear you say that, sorry. That must be when I was unplugged.
I wasn't aware of that.
Oh, I was under that impression that we didn't let people from the armed forces or the police in the party.
Well, I would be very much against that, frankly. I mean, why the armed forces and not the police then?
Well, I thought it was the police and the armed forces and prison officers.
Oh, no. It's not.
Oh, maybe I've been misinformed.
Anyone else know anything about that?
No, I've not heard. I've not heard anything, Howard. But I'd be. I mean, I'd be reluctant. I'd be horrified if active members of the army were allowed in. I can't imagine wanting to join, to be quite honest. Not while they're serving members.
That's a different thing, isn't it, though?
Yeah, it is. It is. And I've no idea. I guess best person to ask would be Adam.
I mean, it shocks me a bit because, Paddy, you earlier on were talking about how you were attracted to anarchism as a youngster. I've always thought anarchists were closest around to our case. And I've just been doing a review of a recent anarchist pamphlet by a group called the Anarchist Communist Group, who broke away from Anarchist Generation or something a couple of years ago. They produced this pamphlet called Food, Health and Capitalism, COVID-19 and Beyond. Be good, actually. A lot of what's in it is pretty much the kind of thing we would say, except it sort of fades out a bit at the end because it has to go on about all the things we need to do now would have, you know, raise people's consciousness and make life better now and so on and so forth. So, all my stuff, really. But I've had a look at their website and they've got a page called Join. And it says, if you want to join the Anarchist Communist Group, here's what you need to do. And it doesn't seem as stringent as what we ask people to do. I answer a questionnaire. It says, read and agree with the aims and principles, participate in activities, pay subs. But then there's a section which says, now check, you're not one of the following people. You cannot join the AC. And I'll read you the list. Police and prison officers, so they've got that. Those who have the power to restrain or imprison in detention centres of all varieties. Bailiffs, full-time paid trade union officials, members of political parties, strike breakers, people who have ultimate power to hire and fire, or those whose primary role in the workplace is to hire and fire. Those who have the ultimate power to remove benefits. Those who make a living out of the exploitation of others. So they're obviously excluding a lot of people. I suppose my view is that we shouldn't exclude anyone. We've had capitalists, we still have in the party. So what?
Can I chip in here? Yeah, it's actually, you know, having served in the army and also served as one of Her Majesty's prison officers and also as an industrial manager within the prison system, I can tell you for absolute sure that it is an offence under Queen's regulations in the military and under the prison regulations disciplinary code to actually participate in any political activity. So they're already covering that base.
Actually, Keith Scully absconded to, that's where he went, isn't it? The anarchist communist, our former comrade, Keith Scully. And the anarchists, as far as I know, regard those people as working class traitors.
Yes, I've been told that anyone who's a manager of any description is also persona non grata as far as some anarchists are concerned, which was a surprise to me. I once held a sort of lowly managerial job, so I presume that would have excluded me as well.
Does anyone have any suggestions as to how we would approach this, what we would do, what alternatives do we have? We just have to wait until they see the light. Anyone else have any suggestions?
I think what we've got, you know, the argument we've got to put is that just as there are backward sections of the working class who currently are vast distance from seeing the light, they, you know, when we're closer to socialism, far more people will do that. and that will include members of the army, members of the police force as well. I mean, surely that will be the case. If you've got, I don't know, 70-80% of the population want socialism, is it conceivable that there'll be a large number of people in the army and the force or whatever who are not at all persuaded by those ideas and are in fact prepared to shoot, kill their fellow workers in order that those ideas shouldn't be put into practice?
It would be nice to have some sort of sense of a more practical strategy, though, as well as just hoping. For example, among some birds, there's a practice called mobbing. When they're attacked by a predator, a hawk or a kestrel, what they do is mob the kestrel so it gets confused. They all fly around it so it doesn't know who to go for, and it and gets completely confused by this close crowd of birds that fly all around it. Workers in a revolutionary situation, one of the tactics that we would have, given when we remember that we run society already between us, given sufficient organisation, we also control the communications, we control the transport, the supplies of fuel, and certainly with a small reactionary force, I think that a practical strategy would be to mob it in a sense to deprive it of its fuel, communications, and enclose it by crowding it in. I've seen a similar thing done at nightclubs when someone kicks off. Somebody decides to, they're a bit drunk and they want to fight. What happens is that I've seen it happen. It is quite amazing. Some four or five quite burly bouncers all close in on the individual. And they don't assault the individual in any way. They just close right in, so that the person is completely surrounded by these bouncers. And then they sort of walk as a kind of single unit towards the front door and expel the person out of the door. So that person is actually not able to move or go anywhere because he's completely hemmed in by all the bouncers. It's quite an impressive tactic. It's it's completely the opposite of a violent tactic.
You're assuming that by the time we have these powers to do all these things, to stop this and stop that, you're assuming that the army and the armed forces would still have that much power. That's not congruent, is it? You know, they're part of the working class, and if we've got the control, then I'm assuming that the army would have been depleted by then. Would we need to have to do that?
Well, we don't know, do we? All we can do is make assumptions and guesses at the moment. But I was, you know, I think that we ought to be able to make sort of something more than a kind of vague, you know, express something more than a vague hope in this situation. We hope that the army will be with us. What do we do if some of them are not? I do take the point that they are workers and that therefore lots of them will be with the revolution, but some units may not be, and we need to be aware of that and have some kind of idea what to do about it. So I think, you know, cutting off communications, fuel, blockading roads, things like that. These are all things that would be, on the table.
I think you also have to, you know, looking at a situation as society move towards a more socialist outlook. The powers that be who control the purse strings still going to absolutely ensure that the police and the military and the intelligence services are well fed, well clothed, and well cared for. I think it's cloud cuckoo land to think that they will be the last people to come on side. I know it's a pessimistic view. I certainly have it, having served in the military and seen how ordinary people like me behaved back then, and undoubtedly still do today.
But I'm not there, and you've changed. Why can't they change? How come you've seen the light, so to speak? You're not, you know.
Well, we all have the education process that we go through life. I mean, mine actually started in the army, because it may seem very strange. I find it difficult talking about it in this sort of format, but sitting around with a small group of people where I can see faces, now I can explain, and I can see whether people are grasping what I'm saying and understanding what I'm saying. But that was the beginning of my education on, for example, the bloody hell are we doing in this country? You know, places like Aden and Borneo and what have you, you know. If I was in the position of the people I was fighting against, I'd have taken up arms against the intruders, against the colonial forces, to do something about it. I understand where they're coming from, but that process for me began in the army. It was a very, very slow one. I began to recognize that the job that I was doing, just one small cog, was never going to bring about a better world. As I say, that education for me began back in the 1960s. People come to where they are, or they come to having a socialistic mindset, if you like, a greater care for everything from the planet to the people on it and the type of society you want. We come to it in different ways, and at different times in our lives. Yes, I changed, but I still have contact, very limited contact, with some of my old army comrades. And most of them, those that are still alive, spend their time over a pint of beer reminiscing in how great it was back when they had the old red berry on their heads and all those wonderful things that we did. They are extremely right-wing and anti societal, I suppose, in an awful lot of ways. They still believe that they're as macho in their heads as they were, you know, when they still had testosterone in their body. So, yeah, we come to it at different times in our lives and in different ways. Some change and some.
I know this is only anecdotal, but years ago when I was, when I was a youth and not hanging around with the anarchists, I worked in a pub that had a lot of squaddies going in it. And at first, when the squaddies came in, I wasn't sure what to expect. I thought that they would just be kind of right-wing yahoos or neo-Nazis, or I don't know what I thought, but... as I got into conversation with them, I discovered that, lo and behold, they talked and thought exactly like other workers that I'd met. They complained about their bosses. They moaned about conditions. One thing that a lot of them agreed on was that they wished they had a union and they wished that they could go on strike. And they were quite envious of lots of other workers for those abilities. And it struck me then that they were really not different from other workers in that sense, at least when they were off duty. So that's always given me some sort of optimism that, although the army does try to change people, it tries to make them into, you know, killers. Underneath, they're still the same people they always were. And they still have their sense of self-interest as workers in very much in mind, I think.
I hesitate to use the words we used to use back in those days, but you were mixing with the wrong sort of soldier, Paddy.
thing is, though, what about recruitment? Now, if we on our way and you know, as we become more social, more enlightened, there were hope. I mean, the army is fed by mostly young men. Obviously, it's women as well now, but mostly young men that can't find a job, that come from areas where there is no work. And it's an alternative. They're not necessarily think that the army is a great idea. I think they think that if they join the army, they will learn a trade. I mean, this was one of their slogans, join the army and learn a trade. So, you know, these are just ordinary boys and ordinary men. And as we go along the path of class consciousness, then maybe some of these lads will see that, you know, maybe there are alternatives. I don't know.
Years ago, Carla, I'd agree with you. They used to have things, you know, join the army or join the navy and get a trade. These days, you don't. The trade you get is the person who fires weapons. That's what your trade is in the army now. The size of the army is very small, so it's professional fighters. All the jobs that used to be done by the soldiers who joined the army to get a trade is now done by civilian contractors. So, you know, the soldier of today is the fighting soldier. Now, I mean, Janet and I know a lot of people in the party, they look down or scorn what goes on in Venezuela. They say it's not socialism. And, you know, I agree. I mean, it isn't. And even Chavez recognized that you couldn't have socialism in isolation. But we went there. And part of the reason we went there was to meet the Chavistas, the revolutionaries. And we did. It was very interesting to see that, you know, there is hope. There is hope. If you can bring enough of the armed services on board with the revolution, as Chavez did, then you've got a chance of maintaining it. And the army was used in very, very constructive way. They had projects. They set up education units. They went around the isolated places. They raised medical standards, education standards, nutritional standards, and the military was used for that purpose. And they were used. It was a very constructive use of the military. It sort of points a way into the future. You know, Janet and I have talked about it. How you could, I mean, not a military carrying weapons. You know, in a socialist society, you wouldn't need that. But you've got an awful lot of young people who have boundless energy, looking for adventure and excitement. One of the reasons why I joined, that was one of the reasons I joined the army back in, you know, was it 1963 or whenever it was precisely for that reason. I didn't think about it philosophically or deeply. It was a gasp. It was a laugh. It was exciting. And these young people will be looking for that. Well, you could have, you know, it's almost like international rescue, couldn't you, where you could use the energies and the enthusiasm and the skills and the what have you of young people, because the world is, regardless of whether socialism comes about, will be a world still plagued by disasters. Country like Turkey, where we live, sits on the two very, very large earthquake fault lines. Just a few days ago, less than a week ago, there was a very big earthquake. Just off the sea in where Marmaris is. Fortunately, it was 37 kilometers deep, so nobody was hurt. No buildings fell down. But people were panicking. I mean, you know, had buildings fallen down, that's the perfect use for, you know, young people's energies, trained young people's, like civil defense used to be many years ago. So, you know, if you can bring enough of the military on side with, or you know, with our revolution, if you want to call it that, then there is hope. But it, you know, unless you can grab their hearts, I think you'd be facing particularly nasty situation, and the mobbing soldiers armed with automatic or semi-automatic weapons will simply result in a lot more people getting killed.
In the bottom, surely, it's a question of culture. With the Black Lives Matter, which is taking place at the moment, the way capitalism is espousing this, I mean, I can't really imagine policemen here or the United States treating black people in quite the same way as they've been used to. It's been difficult to do that because the whole culture says no. And a socialist situation, when you had a majority of people wanting socialism, there again the whole culture would say, "Oh, you can't do this because it's against prevailing mentality. It's against what people want." And you know, if we can do this, where will that get us? But I really do think it's more a question of, I say, culture, mentality, development, if you like, social development, than anything else. And I think one way of looking at this might be, I know you want something more specific, but it is to a large extent bookshops of the future. I don't know exactly what will happen, but nevertheless, is it more than a detail?
Getting back to what Alan was saying, we have talked about this, Alan. I think it's been discussed quite a few times. What we'd have, it wouldn't be an army for killing people, but yeah, we'd have a rescue corps, and yep, we would. I guess we would have exactly that. We'd have young people involved in going out rescuing or whatever they need to be in those various services. So I guess we'd have our own sort of humanitarian, so to speak, army.
Yeah, I agree. It's funny, actually, when Alan was talking about international rescue, at that very moment I had visions of Thunderbirds and Tracy Island. But I thought it was a really good point that in socialism, what we would have to say to the army is, look, it's not the case that we don't want you, you're redundant, and by the way, we hate you anyway. It's a case of saying to them, look, we've got a really important job we need you to do if you're up for it, and this is what it is. And presenting the case for socialism in a way that relates to people in the army, that they can understand sort of jobs that they may have been called upon to do in the past. As Alan mentions, you know, disaster relief and things like that. I think it's really important that that point that Alan's made there, giving the army something to do, and not just saying to them, "You're just an obstacle. You're just in the way. We're worried about you preventing the revolution." Instead of that, us saying, "Actually, you can be absolutely crucial to making socialism a really great success."
I mean, they've got to be trained differently, really, because a lot of places, you know, when the army turns up to help after an earthquake or some sort of disaster, they're a bit useless. It's the local people in the area that know what to do, really. The army can be a hindrance, or, you know, they'd have to be trained in rescue and different things, you know, because I've heard that, you know, when the army turns up to aid for aid in some of these things, it's worse than useless, really. You know, that you'd have to have an outfit of people that knew what they were doing and how to do it. The army don't always have those skills, really.
Well, that's true, but it's because they're not actually geared for that.
That's right, yeah. So they'd have to be geared for it. Yeah.
Well, they would be, wouldn't they, in socialism? That would be their entire purpose.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You know, here in Turkey, I mentioned earthquakes here, and they're happening every day. Most of them you don't even notice. From time to time, there are big ones, and, you know, because of the nature of the capitalist system, some not all buildings, but a lot of buildings have been built in substandard ways. bribes put off inspectors, or there is no inspection. There's been examples, contractors just getting sand from the beach, and you can imagine, without washing it, using it in cement. I mean, it just rotted the reinforcing through, and buildings fell down. Now, what we've noticed here is that first people on the scene, of course, are the local people. And it goes back to the discussion, you know, we're always having about human nature. And you only have to see how these local people behave without the slightest thought for their own safety around them. They are delving into dangerous buildings, people out digging. The rescue services, the gendarme, the police who turn up, often get in the way, make a bloody nuisance of themselves. They'd be better off keeping them well away from it. Here, the primary rescue service here in Turkey is called AKUT. It's an acronym for really a civil defense and disaster rescue organization. And they have civilians trained in, you know, in this civilian organization, a volunteer organization, in all sorts of things. They're mountaineers, potholers, miners, you name it. These people are trained. So they bring those skills to the scene of collapsed buildings in earthquakes. They have rescue dogs and all sorts. You've got to have the skills. You've got to be trained. And when we talk about using young people, normally perhaps have gone into the armed forces. Yes, of course they would have to be trained. They would need the skills for dealing with floods and earthquakes and fires and God knows what else. There's no reason why you couldn't have. We should have hope that a better world is possible, and that young people can be directed in a constructive and useful way.
Well, if we haven't got a rule about not letting in people from various occupations, such as the armed forces and the police, why don't we ever direct any propaganda to those workers?
Good idea, but perhaps we should be doing that.
I would add that any soldiers or probably police found with such propaganda on them would very short order dealt with, I think. I'm not decrying the idea. Yeah, we need to talk to people in the armed services. I'm not sure. I mean, you'd probably end up with the party being accused of sedition or something. I don't know. I'm pessimistic about it, I have to be honest. Bringing round the army, especially these days, in British Army, is a very, very tight knit family. They've had a really in the world a very peculiar family oriented structure, and you know, you I think you would talk to most serving soldiers and ask them, you know, who do you fight for, Queen and country, and they'd laugh in your face. You'd ask them, well, you know, what do you think about how people think about you, you know, the civilian people back in the UK? They tell you, we don't give a toss. So I know in my day, in the, you know, 60s and through that period, you know, we didn't give a toss what the public thought of us in the UK. It didn't matter. I'm rambling a bit because, I really do feel pessimistic about it.
It's difficult enough trying to convince people who are less nationalistic, more sympathetic. It's hard enough convincing them, let alone the armed forces.
Yeah, I mean, Carla, it's also this thing of, you know, I lost my thread about who they're fighting for. You know, they'll tell you they're fighting for themselves, their mates, the crack, and for the pay at the end of the month. It's really is very much like that.
I was saying earlier that I thought there had been material, British material, in the Standard about, not exactly directed towards, but about the police, armed forces. As we were speaking, I've had a quick look at the party's website, and there, and I found an article on the armed forces. Trouble is, it's from 1912. I'm sort of looking what there is about the police. There are a few articles that have appeared in the Standard, but it's true we haven't directed our propaganda directly towards them, and for some obvious reasons for that. Sorry, the other thing I was going to say was that a good many years ago, in Swansea Branch did have a member, very good member, who was a railway policeman. It didn't cross our minds that there's anything wrong with this, that we should say, you know, are you sure you should be in the party and a policeman? He was a real policeman and he was spying on us. I don't think so, though. Don't think so.
Yeah, but people like the railway police, they probably don't have that much power. I mean, even if they all got together, what are they going to do? Throw people off trains?
Well, it might be worth addressing some stuff to workers in uniform, just to underline the fact that, as far as we're concerned, they are workers and they're workers like everyone else. And maybe to sort of break down the kind of degree of alienation that workers in uniform often feel for civilians. A friend of mine was a squaddie for quite a long time, and he expressed quite a lot of resentment about civilian attitudes to the armed forces. In his view, the armed forces were doing a useful job. They were necessary to protect civilians against other countries' armed forces and this sort of thing. And he couldn't understand the lack of gratitude by ordinary workers. So, you know, that could be a line of approach we could take to explain to workers in uniform why civilians feel the way they feel and why socialists feel the way we feel, that the only reason why they're necessary is because all other countries think that the military is necessary. So they're all in socialism, we wouldn't have to have any of those people, and they wouldn't have to put themselves at risk in the way that they currently have to do. So it doesn't have to be a sort of aggressive approach. It could be a, you know, sort of reasonably sympathetic approach, and to say, well, we understand your situation, but these are the political realities.
Now, you're one of the editors of the Socialist Standard, about recommending that somebody write an article. I'm sure there hasn't been one for a long time on forces, the armed forces and the police, their position in capitalism and our view of them in terms of a socialist scenario.
It seems, you know, and quite topical because of all the protests and riots and anti-police brutality. I mean, it might be a good time to bring another article up, Paddy.
Okay, well, I would suggest asking Alan to do one, but seeing as he's so pessimistic, maybe that wouldn't be a good idea.
I think I did a couple of things about the army quite a number of years ago now, Paddy. You probably find them on the archive somewhere.